Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Doran Rosenfeld, and I've got a great show for you tonight. I can't wait because two Buddhism practitioners are going to tell us about going inside to find what you need, not going out. So it's C. Von Hassett and Rachel Wilkie. They're a married couple. They will discuss his book, Entering the Mind. There is a place beyond even simple meditation, a place where you become aware of your awareness to experience the totality of space, freedom, and oneness with infinity. This is your mind in its natural state, where your ego, your I-ness, your labels, or your addictions just disappear. Hassett maintains that once you've stepped into and over the threshold to experience this awakened state, it's easier and easier to attain it. And there is no going back. Being bogged down in the conceptual mind pales in comparison and holds no attraction. Entering the Mind is a guidebook which lays open the deepest secrets taught in the Tibetan Buddhism tradition of Dzogchen, considered the highest wisdom practice known to man. No need to go live in a cave in India or become a lifetime follower of a guru. Hassett hands you the key to this beckoning doorway with age-old meditation practices that take you straight into pure consciousness. There you will find not a nothingness, but what you experience firsthand is an emptiness, an incredible spaciousness, and therein lies your freedom. With remarkable clarity and beautiful prose, has enabled you to travel the inner path to a state of no depression, no fear, no anxiety, and no worry. A writer, editor, and publisher of Riot Material magazine, C. Von Hassett practices Dzogchen, an ancient way pointing the individual inward toward the recognition of their own mind, towards awakening. He and his wife, Rachel Reed Wilkie, are committed to bringing Dzogchen to the wider world as a way to open the wellspring of love, joy, compassion, ease, and peace for all of humankind. Oh, calm me down just reading this. Hello there, Chris and Rachel.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Doran. How are you?
Good.
Yes.
We're so happy to be here.
Yes, I'm so glad. Okay, why don't you guys introduce yourselves beyond what I said and just kind of tell a little bit about yourselves.
Well, we've been together for 12 years, and we do everything together. We are complete partners in life and love, and we just love the life that we've created together. We're practitioners of Dzogchen, and we get up every morning and drink our tea and then practice, and then we begin our day. And this just brings us so much joy.
Sorry about that. Rachel and I we practice together, but we also do everything else together. We create art together. We do art shows. We have a magazine called Riot Material, which looks at the art world from a literary perspective, but which means it's excellent writing to go with your dose of art. So, you know, with that together, we just have a beautiful day each day.
Okay. Well, since I have never heard of Dzogchen before, why don't you explain what that is?
Dzogchen is a relatively simple practice. So, it's practiced at the peak of the Buddhist tradition, though most Dzogchen practitioners don't really align with being a Buddhist. Basically, Dzogchen moves above Buddhism like clouds might move above a peak of a mountain. It really is something special in the sense that it's the one tradition that doesn't really hold any dogma. It just points you towards the nature of your own mind, and it asks you to just take a look at it. And so really it's saying, go inward, look at this mind that's not doing much. And when you find that mind that's not doing much, sit down and rest and just observe it. And in the observation, the wisdom begins to arise within, clarity begins to arise within, spaciousness begins to arise within, and this begins to move outward and begin to imbue every aspect of your life. And so you're not doing much but observing this thing that's not doing much. So it's quite an amazing tradition.
That's interesting. So people from every political, religious, philosophical mindset come into this tradition.
Yes,
absolutely. You don't have to be affiliated with any religion in particular, and you could be religious in a certain church or belief system, but you can still enter into the practice of Dzogchen.
I'm not a Buddhist, but I studied under some amazing Buddhist teachers, and I've studied Buddhism, but I don't align myself with this idea of I'm a Buddhist. And nevertheless, every step of Buddhism, at every level, is pointing you toward Dzogchen. So you can't escape any areas of Buddhism that does not, in the end, lead you up to this tradition that moves then outside of Buddhism. It kind of like lifts out of it and just it presents itself as space presents itself to us as, you know, as objects.
That's very interesting, because you don't hear about many philosophical frameworks like this having no dogma attached to them.
Yes, I know. It's fascinating, and that's the beauty of it. Because there's no red flags to trip you up, you know, like, oh, really? You know, like, you know, if you have any doubt or if you're dubious in any way of religion of any kind, you know, there's not a single red flag in Dzogchen that might, you know, set you back a little bit. And yet, nevertheless, if you've been practicing Buddhism all your life, everything about Dzogchen is a recognizable phrase or idea. So it really is, again, like space, it allows for everything. And Dzogchen is this.
Very interesting. So how did you two find it yourself?
Well, I was introduced to it by Chris. So maybe, Chris, you tell the audience how you first came across
it. You know, I've been a lifelong seeker of of my own consciousness, my own like higher self, so to speak, since I was a child, just, you know, wondering why I'm on this planet. And there was a lot of confusion about being on this planet that just kind of drove me deeper and deeper into all the different kinds of philosophies. What first really began to resonate with me was Native American philosophies and teachings, mm-hmm. and, you know, the almost nearly shamanism that began to make sense to me, because I'm a man of the earth. And of course these earthly traditions really made sense to me. And ultimately, thing about Dzogchen is there's another tradition in Tibet called Bon. And Bon is a shamanistic tradition. And all the way up to Dzogchen, the two traditions have nothing in common. But once at the peak of Bon and at the peak of Buddhism is Dzogchen. So it moves through the shamanistic traditions, and it is, again, the peak of these traditions. So from the Native American tradition, I was just like, okay, well, this is still not enough for me. I'm a man of the modern world, and I'm living in the city. I was living in Los Angeles, and I was just being pulled further into there's got to be something out there that's speaking to this curiosity that I have. And ultimately, I did stumble on Buddhism, and that was interesting to me, and they were speaking to some ideas that really made sense. But then I read there in the footnotes of a couple of books I was seeing references to Dzogchen. So I started researching Dzogchen and found some teachers here in the state, and it was no turning back. And this was somewhere time in the 90s, I think.
Very interesting. So it just went with the way you thought.
It does. And that's the lovely thing about it. It supports thought initially. And Dzogchen is asking you to look at your own thoughts. Because thoughts are really what, in a sense, reflections of the dual world we live in, where we see ourselves in relation to everything else. And oftentimes in opposition to everything else. And that oftentimes is born of the thought. It's born of the I entity that perceives these thoughts as a, you know, I'm this and you are that. Dzogchen is asking you to just go in and look at the source of the thought. Where are those thoughts arising out of? Where also is your own I-ness arising out of, that me in you? Where is it arising? And you're looking for it continually early on. And over time, you begin to recognize that there is no source for either. And what you begin to recognize in this pursuit of thought and the pursuit of the self, essentially, is that it arises out of nothing. But it is not a nothingness, because what is recognizing this nothingness? Well, that's your awareness. And so now you're moving into this, moving into recognizing your own awareness, which is giving rise to the self of sorts. And that's where the practice really takes root.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So a lot of people come to this at different points in their own life, in their own search for whatever has meaning for them.
I mean, I discovered Dzogchen much later in my life through Chris. He introduced me to it. But it was something that resonated with me instantaneously. I do love to read books, and I do love the word, and I do love the beauty of language and literature, and how that can tap into our imagination and tap into our dreamscape and tap into our beautiful, like forever evolving stories and imagination. And so reading some of the books from the great Tibetan masters, I found it so intriguing, because I realized that they had studied rigorously in a very scholastic way to really put words to this this essence of being, which is really quite indescribable. But the great masters are taught with words and language to teach and to share and to walk you step by step through this philosophical conceptual landscape, to use the conceptual mind to lead you into that space within you, which is the non-conceptual mind. And so if you enjoy this journey of self-discovery, which ultimately will lead to a sense of self-realization, you can really enjoy The process of discovering yourself through this conceptual way of viewing the world to the point where your perspective on your inner world will shift. And it's this beautiful moment when your perspective shifts and you almost feel yourself cross over that very fine membrane which takes you from this material three-dimensional world that we live in with our thoughts and our labels and our constructs and all of the stories that we tell ourselves, and you slip past the veil into this spaciousness where actually none of that matters anymore, and it falls away, and the labels fall away, and the anxiety falls away, and the fear falls away, and then you feel that you're able, with practice, you're able to rest in that space. And when you do this on a daily basis, you rest in that space a little bit longer and a little bit longer, and you become more and more familiar with this space, and you realize that you are actually residing in your own nature. And it really is a beautiful sensation and a beautiful place to be. And you then, from that space, you just observe, and you observe your inner world, you observe the outer world. And everything is arising and everything is falling away, and everything is arising and everything is falling away. So it's almost like you experience just the natural flow of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, the individual landscape of your own mind. So is it better to practice this, Dzogchen, individually, or as you two do every morning, or with somebody?
Well, yes, and that is entirely your choice. Obviously, Chris was meditating for many, many decades on his own, and you can just as easily begin that path on your own. We meditate every morning together, and we're sharing the space in which we meditate, but it is an individual journey because each person has their own perspective. And so each consciousness is an individual perspective. And yet what happens when you follow down your own inner path, your own individual consciousness ultimately will merge with the universal consciousness. And at that point, you are at one with all. But the practice and the journey to get there is an individual one, and this is what is so beautiful about Dzogchen. It really is a set of unique teachings because it really teaches you that you have an individual consciousness and you have an individual perspective, and this is your own mind. But with your mind, with training your mind, you can really go deep to the point where then your mind merges with the universal mind.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so you can come to this at any point in your life and maybe have a different experience of it at different times.
Really, it's as you know, some of these practitioners, you know, when the Buddhist teachers or these Tibetan teachers speak to the practitioner whose capacity is so high that all he has to do is hear these teachings one time and it all makes sense to them. They sit down and they awaken. Mm-hmm. Most of us, however, we're all at different levels and different levels of development. So as we receive the teachings, they resonate in different ways for each of us. However, as teachings begin to take root within and you begin to experience the space of your own personal individualized awareness, you're moving into a space that is ineffable. There's no language to describe it. Only metaphor really can point you toward it. But when the great masters speak to this space, they're speaking to a space that's pretty much the same for everyone, except for all the enlightened beings, except for that each one has their own perspective on that space. So, mm-hmm. You know, we could speak to our space here on Earth as, you know, a paradise or a hell realm, or depending on where we are, where our head is at. it could be any or all of it at any time. But when you move into, when you practice and you eventually arrive at this awakened state, it is a state that gives rise to everything. And so the language that's being put to it is all very similar. And what gets a little bit frustrating with reading all of the great teachings on Dzogchen is you begin to hear the same ideas over and over again, which on the one hand is great because it reinforces, like, you know, like you could spend a couple of years reading a single idea and it doesn't quite land for you. And so you get a little bored with it or you think it's a cliche. But then when you ultimately move into and realize what that phrase is speaking to, then it makes sense. You go, oh, wow, I've been reading that or I've been listening to that idea for 10 years now, and I just felt like dead language. But now I get it. So it's really an interesting tradition. You really have to bridge the language for yourself to get into your own self, because the language will ultimately lose its meaning if you just keep rereading and rereading and rehearing and rehearing. It loses its ability to point. So you really have to help that language get there by sitting there and practicing and allowing yourself to take that leap.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So I assume this book that you wrote, Entering the Mind, tells a little bit about how to do it, how to become involved in this.
Well, it was about a year and a half now ago that I was really moving in my practice in ways that it took me 20 years to, you know, sitting in practice for 20 years and making incremental movement into and feeling good about my practice. But, you know, it was helping in various ways in many aspects of my life. But then suddenly, also it was having to do with just really allowing myself to sit for many hours in the day and also stopping drinking altogether and, you know, get the smoking out of the way, clean up the diet, you know, making sure that the body is really receptive to what I was pursuing. And in doing all of that, all of the teachings began to click, and I began to recognize this natural state that I've been, pursuing all these years. And then realizing that it's right here. It's right here. Wow. You know, this is incredible. And so I stabilized in that, and after a couple more years, I recognized that maybe it's time for me to speak to it, not from a teacher's perspective, but from a practitioner's perspective, you know, so I can speak to my fellow practitioners or also people who are very interested in trying out this practice. So as a writer, I really was obliged to make this as clear as possible. So I wrote pretty much 90% of the book while sitting in practice at 2 or 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, from this place, what we call the natural state, and writing it directly onto my phone in the dark. And then the next day and every day, translating it and evolving the language. So for me, it was as clear as possible. And then Rachel began to read the book, and she became a great editor for me to help, again, continue to clarify the language. So it is a book that really speaks as best as possible to what this natural state looks like. And also it's using updated metaphors, so to speak. You know, it's I'm a Western practitioner. So, and I'm also a writer. I'm a writer who loves to observe nature, and nature is one of the essential elements of this practice. And so to employ the metaphors of nature for me was made sense to speak to some of these higher level concepts. So in that sense, it is different than many of the Tibetan texts that you'll be reading, because the Tibetan texts speak to it in somewhat abstract terms. And I wanted this to be almost a map, like a real step-by-step guidebook to get you from point A to point Z. And that was the goal, and I feel I've accomplished it, and you know, I'm getting some good feedback, so I think it's landed.
Okay, because throughout my life so far, I mean, I've been around a while. I've never heard of this practice before. So is it well known?
Well, it's beginning to become well known. It was actually kept quite secret for many, many centuries, simply because the Tibetans really held it in a high position within their tradition. And so back in the day, the Tibetan master was actually only allowed to transmit their teachings to one student in their lifetime. And so this was, it was considered extremely revered as a tradition. And so for hundreds of years, this tradition was taught, but shared in a very, very private, secret way. And even some masters, there's a beautiful chapter in the book that speaks to a master who shared his teachings with his student through a hole in the cave or in the monastery from one little meditation room to another meditation room, and actually transmitted the teachings through a straw into the ear of his student. So that no other student could actually hear those teachings, because as C mentioned earlier, they recognized that people had different capacities, and there were certain, and that's not to say that anybody's better or worse than anyone else, but it was, they understood that these teachings were so pure, and they directed you directly to your natural state, that they were so precious that they wanted to make sure that the student that received those teachings was truly ready for them, so that when they actually received those teachings, they could pretty much instantaneously enlighten on the receiving of those transmissions. And so this went on for many hundreds of years. And then up in the 50s, China invaded Tibet, which was a tragedy for the country and for their tradition. It was, though, on the positive side, it was a blessing for the Western world, because many of the Tibetan masters were able to escape and retreat into exile, and many of them found their way to either Europe or America, and they were able to survive, number one, thank goodness, and they were also able to then bring the teachings to the Western world. And there was a great master amongst them who prophesied this invasion of China and actually taught them that this will happen within our near future, and when we are entering into the West, it is at that point that we need to begin to share these Dzogchen teachings with a wider audience. And so the Tibetan masters actually began to hold retreats and hold sangha and invite Westerners to their teachings. And so rather than passing the teachings down to one student in their lifetime, they could perhaps sit with a couple of hundred of students, or maybe 20 students, or so bit by bit, these amazing, incredible teachings were actually shared amongst the Western communities, those who were ready to listen. So this, I would say it culminated in its first wave of interest, I would say, around the 90s. And so the 90s, some of the Tibetan teachers were really traveling a lot, visiting Western states, visiting Europe, and really making these teachings available to many more people. And that's actually in the time when C was attending many retreats and getting great teachings directly from the masters. So it's really, like you say, it's not so well known, but we believe that it's becoming a little bit more popular, and more people are resonating with it. So this is a really, really exciting time for this tradition.
Yes, I'm sure, because it's attractive to think that anyone at any level can experience this, because there's not many things in life that are at such a universal level.
That's right. That's absolutely true. And I do strongly believe that as we give birth to new generations, as now I'm speaking from a species perspective, I do believe that as we give birth, more conscious human beings will be giving birth to more conscious children, and our children will inherit that level of consciousness. So there is a natural growth in the collective consciousness as we continue to give birth to these beautiful children who just, they're born into this world with, they're slightly more awake than we were, and their children will be more awake than their children. And so we see that the collective consciousness is growing, and this is such a positive effect that it's having on our communities and on our perspective of life. So it's really exciting. So I believe with that growth in consciousness, the collective capacity will increase too. So more and more people will be ready for these teachings and can pick up these teachings at almost any level and still get so many benefits from them.
Very interesting. So not only do you change with the practice, but the practice changes with you in it.
Well, that's, I don't know about that last bit in the sense that
okay. We
definitely change as a result of the practice, but the practice, I even say in the book, the teachings themselves are flawless. In other words, they don't change because they're pointing to it. Like if I was to talk about space, if we were looking at the space directly in front of us where, say, our chair is and the stove, the space allows for these things to happen. But no matter when or how we speak to space, it never changes. We recognize that space is empty. It's ongoing. And it doesn't change. What we do understand about space is that it allows. So while things in space change, space does not. And this is exactly true for Dzogchen, because Dzogchen, if you want to understand the essence of Dzogchen, then look at the space in front of you and say, ah, that's what I'm trying to understand on a deeper level. Now, the difference between space and your own awareness is that that awareness has a sense of knowing. So awareness and space are one. So the emptiness is the space part, and the knowing is the awareness part. And so it's that we're gravitating towards an understanding of this that never changes. No matter how much we change, the essence
right.
of where we're going to or we're trying to understand will not change.
Right. Well, I'm not saying that this awareness, which, like you said, is perfect and it's not going to change, but it's going to change in the way that we perceive it, the way
exactly.
we relate
yes.
to the world.
Yes, exactly. So if one is perceiving the world in negative terms or as a hell zone, as you move through these teachings, your perception on the things in the world and the world itself changes dramatically, and so thus does the world. I think exactly as you're saying, perception changes everything, including what we're perceiving.
Right. That's what I meant by that. I mean, you can get into some really weird things here.
Yes,
that's
true.
Right.
I mean, it can get very convoluted, but you just have to keep untying it and trying to make sense of it.
And so tell me, when you're in heavily into this meditation and you're experiencing this emptiness, this energy, are you aware that you are the one seeing this energy for yourself, or is the I totally gone?
No, the problem with the eye is it gets in the way. So one of the first things that you do is you begin to observe this eye, and there's a practice in Dzogchen or also in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it's called Chod, and Chod has you look at this eye through. There's one particular tradition that has a practice that. If you're sitting and you're observing yourself, you're looking at your body and you're saying, okay, I am Sivan Hassett. Okay, where is this Sivan? Where is this I? And you're looking at your body. Well, if I'm conceptually seeing it as the totality of myself, then it must be in every aspect of my body. And so in your practice, in the meditation, which is an imaginary practice, you look at your foot and you say, where is my eye in that foot? Is my eye in that foot? And then you recognize that there is no eye in the foot because there's no foot in the foot. There's skin in the foot. There's toes in the foot. And you begin to pull these things apart, and you cut off the feet because you don't want them to distract you later on when you're trying to hone in on that eye. And you get all the way up. You cut off the arms and the legs, and you get all the way up to the heart and the head, and you're still looking for this eye, but in the body, that even the body can't hold the name of, you know, so the arm doesn't hold that name. There's nothing about the arm that is an arm because it's just, again, more cells in it, all the way down to atoms, all the way down again to empty space. So with this continual practice, the hold the eye has on your awareness begins to loosen. And in that loosening, as the eye begins to disappear, the thoughts also with it begin to settle. And then now you begin to recognize, well, what was doing all that observing? What was doing all that seeking? And it is the awareness that is always and will forever be your own awareness. This awareness will take on multiple bodies. It takes on bodies in dreams. It will take on a body in death. It will take on an imaginary body in death. It will take on a physical body in various lifetimes and reshed these bodies. So what is it that's doing this? It's your awareness. And this is the awareness we're now moving toward understanding and stabilizing in. And so it really is a movement towards this. And this is complicated if your body is not healthy, if you're suffering from conditions that are not allowing your awareness to settle properly, if you're riddled with diseases, you really need to try to help clean up that body or to figure out ways to move into the awareness being, because the body does have an incredible pull on our awareness in so many different ways, through addictions, through abuse, through you study brain injuries, I'm understanding. You know, these can make it difficult for us to settle into our own awareness, which is just like space. So on the one hand, we could say Dzogchen is an easy, philosophically it's easy to understand, but in practice it becomes quite rigorous and difficult at times.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So someone who knows nothing about the Buddhist tradition beyond a little bit here and a little bit there, what would prompt them to get involved with this practice?
Well, this practice really, it's like anything else that you might wish to practice in your life. It does take a commitment, per se. If you were to, for example, if you were interested in learning yoga, you wouldn't necessarily walk up to a yoga mat and just immediately stand on your head. You would, right? You would think to yourself, okay, I think I'm going to take some lessons and I'm going to just start slowly. I'm going to start by stretching and moving and building up body strength and muscle, you know, muscle memory. And, you know, so Dzogchen is, and all meditation really to that point is, you should see it like a training, like anything else. And so it's really how to find a space for yourself each morning, or it could be evening. I mean, Chris and I prefer the mornings initially, but you can do it at any time of the day. But it's really about finding a time of the day that suits you where you can just sit with yourself. That's number one. If, you know, if you don't have a regular meditation practice already, then really you start there, because it's about being still. It's about sitting with yourself, and it's about finding a space and a time that you can just sit there and be still. Because that in itself, even if you just did that, and even if you just sat there for 10 minutes every day, and then of course you can build up that time and it can lead to 20 minutes a day, half an hour every day, an hour every day, but you can really, really feel a sense of calmness when you just sit with yourself. And this calmness that you experience on a daily basis, you don't need to do anything other than that to reap the benefits that will come maybe after a few weeks, maybe after a few months. It might even take you a year, but if you do a little bit every day, you will feel that a lot of your anxiety and your fear and your obsession, your obsessive thinking, it will just start to diminish and it will start to calm down and it will actually just start to leave you without you actively pushing away your addictions or pushing away your thoughts or pushing away your fear and anxiety. What will happen is that you will actually start to feel them fall away in your everyday life. So the training itself is very, very simple. You literally sit. They do advise that you sit because the whole point is that you sit with cross-legged, of course, a comfortable position with your cross legs. Not everybody feels comfortable crossing their legs, but the idea is that you do sit so that you really open up the wind channels in your torso, because you want your head reaching up to the ethers and the heavens, and you want your root chakra, which is your bum, basically, your butt, you want that grounded towards the earth. So you're really wanting to ground your whole being between the earth and the heavens, because the point is not to just drift off and allow your mind just to go in, almost fall asleep and dream and go off into a dream state. You really want to be actively conscious and awake during the practice. Mm-hmm. And you sit and you literally observe what happens, and you're focusing on your mind. The idea is that you have all of your senses also in a state of receiving. So this particular meditation traditionally suggests that you keep your eyes open, just very relaxed, though, not staring at anything, but just relax your eyelids, but just look a few feet in front of you, so that you have all of your five senses aware. You can still smell and taste and hear and see and touch, so that you train your conceptual mind to just be and to just be still. And of course, when you first start, thousands of thoughts will just fly through your mind and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm just no good at this. I need to, you know. And, yeah. And a lot of people, they feel, oh, I've tried meditation. I just can't do it. My mind goes crazy and I just keep on thinking. And actually, that is okay. That's exactly what is going to happen, because your thinking mind hasn't had this kind of training before. And so your thinking mind is literally thinking constantly. And so that's okay. Don't judge yourself. Don't judge the thoughts. Don't judge the thoughts. They will just keep on coming. They will just keep on coming. But if you just do this a little bit every day, what will happen is that the thoughts start to slow down initially. They start to sort of come into your mind in a slightly slower speed. And then after a while, you start to realize, well, these thoughts are, where are they coming from? Where is this thought coming from? And after a while, you'll start to see the beginning of the thought as it starts to arise in your mind. And then you'll actually watch that thought just float away and disappear. So you start to see that these thoughts arise, and they arise out of something. And what they are arising out of is actually this beautiful empty space. And this empty space that the thoughts were arising out of and returning to, that space is actually your natural state. And this is where you start to recognize it. And when you recognize it, and it's not something that you point out and see, but you are pointed to it and you know it and you feel it and you begin to know within yourself that that is your natural state. And then, as C said earlier, then that is when you actually, with time and a little bit more practice, you just keep going, you keep going, and then it gets exciting because you start to rest in that space. And before long, you'll start to experience less and less thoughts. And you'll be able to experience the spaciousness of this natural state. And ultimately, another thought will come, and it may seem like a distraction, but it's only a distraction if you attach yourself to the thought. So what you're doing is you're really, really training yourself also to detach and let these thoughts come and go and no longer attach yourself to the thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, as you were saying, you think all sorts of other things when you first sit down to do that. After you've been doing it for several weeks or months or several years, what happens to you then? Is it easier to sit down and just fall into that state right away?
Yes, it's true, because as Rachel spoke to, the idea of yoga or anything really, to become a doctor, you have to train. And what you're doing is you're training to arrive at this state faster and faster. So, you know, you could spend a couple of years, you know, just dealing with the whole frontal area of your awareness and the thoughts that are arising. But oftentimes with rigorous training, if you're practicing every day, it can happen, you know, you can get pretty stable at it. And there is a practice that I speak to in the book called Shamatha that really helps in that stabilization. It's like a scaffold that you use for your awareness. You know, you use a rock or you use something to hold your attention on until it stabilizes, and then you begin to become aware of that as well. So there is a practice that helps you stabilize quite quickly. And so this is the training. The training is to really move into this natural state with greater and greater speed over time, so that you can become more familiar with it again, and really the resonance of it can begin to imbue your whole entire being. And, you know, the world is always throwing things at us. And so, you know, we're always being destabilized by sudden things, you know, that. And so, you know, as a practitioner, nobody's ever speaking to being fully awakened, but we're speaking to this idea of progressing towards being awakened, like these great masters, like the Dalai Lama, for instance, you know, who, he's a Dzogchen practitioner. He doesn't speak about it. And when everybody gets near this great man, you know, they're like, oh, there's something about him. Well, he's stable. He is stable in his own awareness. There's nothing that's pulling him out and distracting him. And this is what we're trying to attain for ourselves. And we can do it. All of us can do it. We have the ability. We just need these initial teachings to say, this is what it looks like, and this is how you can stabilize. And now it's yours. Now go for it. And then you just practice every day. And then when you need further teachings, you go get them. When you need to understand that, oh, maybe I'm not doing this quite right, you go get, you know, recalibrated, you know, through clarification. And so, you know, it's a process. Like everything else is a process.
Okay, very interesting. So if people can come to it, go away from it for a while, and then come back to it.
Yes, and I did that too. You know, like I was like, oh, fiercely practicing, you know, throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s. And then, you know, like everything else, things go in cycles. And then I kind of moved away from it, but I was thinking about it all the time, but I wasn't necessarily practicing. Because once you kind of get the ideas behind it, they don't really leave you, even though you're not officially sitting down and working with them. And so the ideas hold on to you, and they inform everything that you do. And then you realize that at some point you're practicing again. And this, I can think of like 2 to 3 very deep and prolonged cycles where I was just sitting for hours each day. And then within that, shorter cycles of a couple of years where I wasn't practicing hardly at all, and I was partying much more, and I was much more social, and I was going out and, you know, creating art and doing art shows and things like that. So it's like everything else is a cycle. It's like, it's not like you just get roped in and that's it. This is who you are for the rest of your life. You are a living entity, and these living entities are moving through all kinds of different cycles. So, and Dzogchen allows for this. It supports and says yes to everything that, to who you are, everything that you do. And, you know, but the teachings are continually speaking to you. And so that's the beautiful thing about him.
Very interesting. So tell me, just a personal question, do you, Chris and Rachel, practice in the same place every day?
That's a very good question. And we do, actually. Well, I would say when we practice together, because we wake up in the morning and we both make ourselves tea. And we have different teas. Chris has his Japanese oolong tea, and I have my Chinese jasmine tea. So we actually begin our day by drinking our little pots of tea. We bless our tea. We give gratitude and thanks for the day, and we bless our tea. Then we drink our tea. And then, by the way, I forgot to say that we get up and make our tea, and then we take our tea back to bed. So we love to drink our tea in bed. And actually, we do our first practice of the day in bed, and we do it together. And that is really, it's a preference, it's a personal preference, because we like to make sure that we've done at least one practice a day before we really kick into the day and get going. And and the bed's comfortable because we can prop our backs with a little bit of a pillow if you need a bit of a back support. You know, we can lean against the wall at the tip of the bed, mm-hmm. and we can really get comfortable and make sure that, you know, we're actually committing to that first practice of the day. And so we do that. Having said that, you can practice anywhere that's comfortable for you. I mean, I would say that if you are beginning your practice, then it is, it's a good idea to find somewhere quiet and peaceful that you love and that you feel comfortable, because ultimately it's great to practice in different environments, you know, just to sit, you know, you could practice sitting on a public transport, you know, with all the craziness of, you know, public transport around you. You know, you could be, sitting, take a break in a bar, you know, and sit down in the corner and do it, you know. But really, you know, when you can do it anywhere. And the great masters, I mean, they are in this state of natural state every single second of the day. So they are literally practicing all day long as they are moving through their life and talking to you and being there, as she said, you know, the Dalai Lama, he is in that state of awakened practice his whole entire day, and most likely as he's sleeping too, 24/7, you know. But as beginners, of course, Chris is an advanced practitioner, but it's advisable just to find somewhere comfortable that you enjoy, that makes you feel safe and you feel that you can commit to that space each day. And then, of course, it's great to get out there and experiment and experiment with different noises and different environments and different smells, you know, so that you can actually advance your practice, so that you can actually, as I said before, you can experience all of your five senses while still maintaining that recognition of your natural state.
Huh. Sounds like there's nothing stopping anybody from doing this then.
That's right. That's
except,
right.
Except for the ego.
Yes, except for your own ego.
The ego is the one thing he's going to say, what are you doing, man? You know, you should be out there, you know, cooking yourself dinner, or gosh, I'm going to go get a bag of chips, or, you know, whatever, you know, things that are driving you away. Or the ego will come in and say, oh, you're doing such a great job. Oh, you must be a master now. Well done. You know, it flirts with you. It pulls you away. The ego is continually trying to disrupt your practice, because the ego knows, and I'm speaking to the ego as if it has its own mind, but it's our habitual way of being, and it does not want you to go beneath it, because once you're beneath it, you begin to see it, you begin to see what's been driving you all along, and the ego really doesn't want you to do that. So the ego is going to try to stop you, and trip you up, and send you in the wrong direction, and confuse you. But this is the only thing that is going to prevent us from really being successful in our practice, is ourselves. Because really, once you begin to settle into the natural state, you begin to recognize that nothing about the world is a problem. The world is a beautiful place. And you can really, again, like you said earlier, it's about shifting your perspective so you ultimately see this. But until you see this, the ego is fierce, and it's going to try to trip you up.
So you have to get the ego out of the way to do this effectively.
Yes, you have to become, and by doing that, you're not turning away from the ego. You're looking right at it. You're turning all of your attention right towards it. So it's a face-to-face observance with your own ego. And so in doing that, the ego is going to try to shy away and go hide somewhere else and disappear while you're doing this. And you go, oh, okay, yeah, there's nothing there, and you observe it. But the minute you take your eye off it, it pops right back up because, you know, the ego is a wily little thing. And so you got to turn back and look at it. And so this is what the practice is doing. When you actually sit down to officially practice, you're sitting down to go face-to-face with yourself, with this big projection of self, which has the eye within all the ownerships and all of the interactions and the relationships that we claim as our own. This is all embedded in the ego structure. And so your practice is, in many ways, looking at that big structure above the natural state. And when we speak to the natural state, we're speaking to the state of awareness that is unstoppable, eternal, just as the space around us doesn't end and it has no beginning, no end. We don't see where it goes. It just keeps going. This is our awareness as well, which means it will never die. But in the meantime, what's keeping us from being stable in that space is our ego. So we're always sitting down to face it and to get past it and to become friends with our awareness self.
So it's not fighting yourself, your awareness of yourself, but making friends with it, as you were just saying.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing to fight against. There's nothing to rail against. It's about getting to know. If you're, if you're falling in love with somebody, the best thing you could do is to try to get to know that person before you actually marry them. You know, so you want to spend time with that person and get to know all of their qualities. And in many ways, you're doing this with your ego. But in doing this, ultimately, what happens is the ego begins to disappear. It begins to lighten first and come less problematic, and then it ultimately disappears. Now, that's a process. That's where you're like becoming awakened. For many of us along the path, wherever we are in the practice, the ego is always going to be present. That's part of our social personality. But we can be more in observance of this entity. And the more you're friendly with it, and the more that you're like, oh, there you are again. How you doing, sir? The more it becomes less problematic. You know, you're not fighting. There's no shame involved because you're not trying to hide anything over there or support something here. And, you know, like, I'm so great at this. Oh, and that, and, you know, but I never do that kind of thing. And, you know, all that stuff that we, you know, align ourselves for and against, that begins to fall away as well. And that's all part of the ego structure.
I see. So even when you do this with somebody else, you're actually doing it with your own ego, with yourself.
Yes. Yes.
That's right. Yes. Yes. You might be sharing the same room, the same space as you're practicing, but you really are being with yourself. And that means all of you that comes up in that moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, I see there's some people joining the conversation. If anyone would like to ask any questions, please call the number 424-243-9540. And then when you're on, press 1. And I'll see a little question mark beside your name, and I'll know you have a question. So that's if anyone wants to call in and ask these practitioners here while they're on, while the show is live. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for that, I wanted to ask a further question about the ego. I mean, it's always there. It's always with us. I mean, so is there actually a space where you can get rid of it for a long period of time to practice this effectively? Or do you need it on some level to do this practice?
Well, this driving us towards the practice is the complications that arise as a result of our ego.
Mm-hmm.
So we're searching because we're trying to understand the difficulties of this life. If we were in a state of bliss, there would be nothing pushing us or pulling us towards higher level teachings at all. We would just be sitting there enjoying the comforts of our own experience. So the ego, while there's so much that's beautiful about the ego, you know, art comes out of the ego and intellect mm-hmm. comes out of the ego and philosophies come out of the ego. You know, it's like, you know, it's the mind at work. But it also causes a lot of problems. You know, even though you could be the best human being on the planet, but you're going to have problematic relationships. You know, people aren't going to understand you, so you're going to have to explain yourself, or you're going to encounter people who are going to really do some damage to you. And so these things drive us towards the practice. So the ego, in many ways, is the propelling force. And in that propulsion, we land on ultimately the Dzogchen teachings. And these Dzogchen teachings say, it's not all those things out there that's causing the problems. It's the very thing that helped propel you here, and it's your ego. So let's look at that. Because from the perspective of the eye, we're always looking outwards, and we never really think to look at exactly at what this eye, the essence of the eye. And the Dzogchen teachings say, I'm going to point you back in on yourself, so that you can begin to see the source of all this trouble. And so this is where the teachings begin to kind of like self-swallow. There's a chapter in the book called Ouroboros where, you know, the snake that eats its own tail. So this is what the Dzogchen teachings are doing. It's you're looking outward, and as you look outward, the teachings bring you inward, and ultimately you begin to swallow your own tail. And this is the swallowing of the eye, where you begin to disappear your own eye entity. And so, yes, the ego is the very thing that takes you there, and that where you land is going to be the thing that swallows the ego in the end. But again, this is a process. So it's the practice, it's a daily practice. So, you know, the ego arises throughout the day, and when you get better at the practice, you begin to observe it in action. So if you're at a party, and you're watching your big self come out, and that social self, you could begin to observe it. You don't have to change anything, but you begin to self-observe, and you begin to, like, that inner smile kicks in and says, oh, there you are again, look at you, showing off. But it's not a bad thing. It's a great thing. You know, it's like, I love it, you know, but the skill is having the ability to observe it. And you can observe it if you're a practitioner and you get in a fight with your spouse, you can observe the anger coming up in you, and you can observe the language that's starting to arise in your own mouth. And with that observation, you say, nope, I'm not going to say that. Nope, I'm not going to do that. So it has a utilitarian practice at every level.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So when did people first become aware of this practice, or has it always been around? I mean, you were saying
the Buddha,
90s it sort of became known, but when was the practice actually developed?
Well, this might be a troublesome for your listeners or not, but the masters speak to that these teachings are given throughout 13 solar systems in the universe. So it is a practice born of if our awareness is one with space, space never ends, which means the whole universe is filled with the same space that's here on this planet. So space is everywhere. Awareness can be moved through space because our awareness is not bound to time. So the teachings apparently came to Earth through the greater system of awareness, or through the greater system of space. It arrived here through what the Buddha himself. The Buddha sat for many, many years and pretty much downloaded all of the teachings from the lower level Buddhist teachings all the way up to Dzogchen. So he is given credit for bringing the teachings here to Earth.
Okay.
That being said, they speak to these teachings as being timeless and without any particular place.
Okay. Okay, so it's just there.
It's there. It's there for us to, you know, but the problem is you got to find the teacher who knows about it, because nobody's going to, these teachings, they don't just reveal themselves. Even though they're there, they speak to these teachings that your own awareness, this awareness that they're trying to point you towards, is as close to you as your finger is to space. And I love this metaphor, because when you look at your finger, you don't have to do anything. It's already in space. And so the teachings say, point you to what that space looks like. I've been studying all my life. You know, I'm 60 years old. I've studied all the great philosophies basically on this planet. And not one of them, except for Dzogchen, points you to what this space actually looks like. They speak to everything else, but they don't speak to this one thing. And this is the thing that I'm now recognizing is the answer to the human condition, which is going to allow us to elevate our own consciousness and our own awareness to that of an enlightened being.
Hmm. Very interesting. Okay. I like that. Your finger in space. Yeah. Definitely. Hold up my finger and look at that. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
Look at that finger.
It's right there. It's already there.
Our own inner nature is right there. And all we have to do is, again, like you said, and I think it's such a beautiful thing, shifting your perspective is the only thing you need to do.
Not so easy, though.
No.
Exactly.
It's hard. But
it takes practice.
It's the only thing you need to do, but it's hard.
Yeah. It's just real simple. All you have to do is the hardest thing imaginable. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So people in any stage of life can do this. What about, do you guys think that, you know, like a little baby could do this effectively? No,
because what's interesting, and, you know, again, this is something hard to get your head around. A lot of these great masters are what they call reincarnate masters. They're tulku. Mm-hmm. So they live long lives. They teach, but they've committed to being teachers until all sentient beings become aware. Which means that these great masters die and are reborn. And when they're reborn, even the Dalai Lama himself and all the great masters, they know where they die, and they have all of their possessions. And so then the great masters look for where this old practitioner is going to be reborn, and they search them out. And they receive their own instruction from their own meditation practice and say, okay, but this the reincarnate master is going to be over in this province, and they go to that province and they find the house, and they go to the boy and they go to the parents and they say, we just need to see if this is the great master from 20 years ago. And they show this boy all the things, and the boy is already showing signs of being advanced, and the boy begins to pick out all of his old things. Or the girl.
Mm-hmm.
So then they find it, and they ask the parents. They say, look, this is the great master so-and-so, and he's been reincarnated 10 times since back in the day, and we would love to bring him to the monastery and reteach him. And so that's the interesting thing. He's a baby. He's young. He's just a light presence on earth, but he is not steeped in the actual teachings, because, you know, there's a cleansing that takes place in death. You know, you kind of lose, but the essence of who you are is still there. So they have to, so what they do is they put these students in these monasteries and they reteach them decades, you know, or 10, 20 years. And it's a full on scholastic practice. And these young kids are relearning, and they're not necessarily meditating. They're reabsorbing the actual teachings. They're also meditating, but over time, and so a lot of these great masters who have been reborn, they say that I didn't even begin to understand the Dzogchen teachings fully until I was in my 20s, after all these 10, 15 years of deep, intense practice. So you mm-hmm. almost have to reteach the child the teachings. And so I personally don't think that a child is going to be receptive, because you need your intellect to kind of get your head around these teachings so you can actually go in and use that intellect to understand the space that you're seeing. That being said, they do speak to these young great masters who at 4 or 5 years old already are reciting the teachings that they were giving in their previous life to the masters that, you know, they that are sitting around them. So there are these highly advanced beings that get it right away, but I think most children are not going to be able to get okay. their heads around these teachings for a number of years. Yeah.
But from birth or whatever, from a very young child, being in a monastery learning, you kind of try to get in that mindset earlier.
Yeah, because for instance, there's a few reincarnate masters now who are like 10, 12, 18 years old. These are some of the teachers that you could read the books of the masters who they were prior. And now we see them as young adults, and they don't necessarily have the language to speak to the teachings like their previous incarnation, and yet you recognize that there's something incredibly special about these individuals, and they're now relearning the actual verbal language to now continue to be the teachers that they were. So even though they don't have on the outward level all of the skills to communicate the teachings, on an inward level, there's something there that's quite amazing. And you can, look to all these, great masters then, and where are they now? And, you'll see that they're popped up in that monastery. They're popped up in that monastery. And now they're 13 years old and they're beginning to learn how to teach.
Okay. So do these specific children know who they were previously, or don't they?
Yes, they're told. In fact, one of my teachers who's alive today, Sonya Rinpoche, his father was an incredible master. Urgyen Rinpoche, was considered fully enlightened, and Sonya Rinpoche speaks to his father being fully enlightened. And Sonya himself is a reincarnate individual who, from the previous Sonya incarnation, who they say was an amazing master. So he knows who he is in the line of himself. So it's just ridiculous. The line of himself throughout time, there's like 3 or 4 Sonya Rinpoches, and they rename you, Sonya the third, whatever. And Sonya speaks to, like, looking at his life, and he was a carefree young man, but resisted and rejected at times becoming another master again. He wanted to just enjoy this planet. Ultimately, the calling of himself really presented itself internally, and he found himself, he couldn't help it. He just ended up being a teacher, and he's a great teacher. So, and his brother's a great teacher, and his other two brothers are great teachers, all born of the same amazing father and mother, who's an amazing practitioner as well. So it's like,
so it runs in family.
If you're in the lineage, you're going to get the great teachings.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay. So you said there's no specific dogma associated with this teaching, but I mean, reincarnation of the masters is a part of it.
Yes, but that's not necessarily a dogma. That's the essence of all things. Energy doesn't die.
You're
if a
right.
tree dies, it's a tree has seeds and it dies, it's the seeds fall into the ground and another tree grows. You can't say where one tree ends and the other begins necessarily. So it's just the natural cycle of things. You could create dogmas out of this, yes, but in and of itself, there's no dogma there.
Okay. Beyond that basic teaching that's kind of among all flavors of Buddhism, really.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. True.
Just the space, the world it comes from, yeah. Okay.
And shamanism. Shamanism sees all things as being ongoing and spirits moving on and kind of taking shape in different things. You know, that's a form of reincarnation. You know, reincarnation is just language. Reincarnation is an idea that can be disputed. So, you know, all these things, once you start putting language to it, you know, there's perspectives on it all. But the essence of the journey, the essence of the energy, the essence of the awareness, you can't put it into any category.
Okay, yeah, because energy is not created nor destroyed. It's there. Yeah,
it's
that's
there.
Right.
It's
that's
always
right.
There, and space is always there, and awareness is always there. It's always there.
Yeah. So that's an interesting way of looking at things. Okay. So after somebody spends their life learning this, what is the next step?
Well, I'm seeing myself, I'll use myself as an example. You know, I've been practicing for about 30 years, and I feel that I'm progressing. But I don't feel like I've arrived, and I probably won't arrive in this lifetime. And when I speak to arrive, I want to be an awakened individual, not bound to my ego in any way. I want to be fully aware, as the iconic Buddhas might be, or, you know, this is a pursuit, this is a journey, but really the pursuit itself is just another concept. I just want to continue to practice and deepen in myself, and it could be that at some point it just happens. You know, they speak to these people who are practicing, and they just awaken one day. They sit down, and one day it makes sense to them, and they wake up to who they are. That can happen suddenly, like a lightning bolt. And when you see it and when you fully see the totality of it, you cannot unsee it. And so this is what you call the awakening. My life is in pursuit of that. So I don't see it as a next step. I just see it as a long arc of daily practice until it would be amazing if I can awaken in this lifetime. But if I die, I would expect that my awareness self will continue on with the teachings, with the practice, and that I can continue to practice. So, you know, who's to say what's next or what the next step is? But I think if we look at it as a long process where you enjoy your life, but you continue to practice, I think that's enough.
Mm-hmm. So can you learn this in one lifetime, or you figure you've probably been learning this for many years before this lifetime? Just speaking about you.
Well, yes, I do think you can learn in a lifetime because, you know, like I said, for the first decade for me, it was a slow go. It was an intellectual pursuit for me, and I was trying to understand it on an intellectual level. Still practicing. Mm-hmm. But the last 4 or 5 years for me has been really rapid and profound progress that I myself marvel at, and like, wow, you know, these things are really starting to make sense. Now, in no way do I feel that I'm anywhere close to where I want to be ultimately, like, which is being totally free of my egoic self. But I feel like I've made progress in the last few years that was quite profound. So, and the teachings and the teachers speak to Dzogchen being the one vehicle that can allow you to awaken in one lifetime. So depending on your capacity and depending on how much time you want to put into it, because it's all about how much time do you want to spend trying to become aware. Mm-hmm. And many great masters spent decades inside of a cave. Others have spent, well, all the practitioners spend at least 3 years in retreat, and they do that 2 to 3 times in their life. So they have their 3-year retreats, these great masters. And you know, all of my teachers, they'll be teaching for 5 or 10 years, and then suddenly they're not teaching anymore. Where'd they go? They went into retreat for 3 years. So that's kind of a standard practice. So you can wake up in this lifetime, but it takes your own efforts to get there. So I think that's it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So to be a teacher of this, you can't be doing other things, like have another life outside of it.
I think you can. I do think you can.
There is one teacher that comes to mind. He's the son of Norbu, and he actually runs his own business, which I believe is a marketing consulting business. At the same time, he's followed in his father's footsteps, running his monastery. He's actually Italian. He lives in Italy because Norbu married an Italian woman, and they had 2 children, and the son was recognized as Norbu's uncle reincarnation, and Norbu's uncle was one of his teachers, and Norbu's son was recognized as the reincarnation of the uncle. Now, the son, being brought up in Italy as a modern child, half Tibetan, half Italian, but brought up in southern Italy, he rejected the whole story, and there's a very interesting documentary about it, and he rejected the idea of even entering into Dzogchen and the teachings. But by the time he was, I believe, in his late 30s, early 40s, he actually began to be pulled in. He felt the urge to visit Tibet, because he did not visit Tibet even for his whole life, his old, you know, until he was age. And then he finally, his father was not so well, was struggling with some health issues, and something pulled him there. And then in the end, he did. He visited Tibet. And within the space of a few years, he actually fully embraced the teachings, and he rapidly became a teacher. And he then, as his father's health was failing, he then began to help run the monastery that his father had set up in Italy. But he maintained his business, and he still continues today, I believe, with his marketing consulting business.
Wow.
You know, we run the magazine. We have Write Material magazine, and that's, you know, dealing with, you know, looking at art and dealing with writers and all that. And, you know, you just bring the practice in everything you do. You just bring, what you're doing is just bringing awareness of yourself into all of these different aspects of who you are. And, you know, like we've all arrived, you know, as adults doing things and pursuing careers. And some of us have been kicked off our path and put onto other paths by, you know, the events of the world. And we love what we're doing. And yet being a practitioner doesn't negate any of that, doesn't ask us to abandon any of that. It's especially Dzogchen. Dzogchen says, continue to live your life, but now bring awareness into everything that you do. And what this does is it allows you to really enjoy the relationships that you're in and your relationship to all things in a totally different way, less unconsciously, much more consciously. And everybody appreciates the change that takes place, you know, because you just become a kinder individual and a more thoughtful individual just by doing your practice.
Okay, so it's possible to have a, you know, real money-making job in the real world while you're doing this.
You can do it. Now, if you're in a really stressful job, it could problem for the practice, you know, because stress is not the best thing for, you know, for your health or for your mind. So ultimately what many people find is the more they practice, the more they, their careers begin to realign with the practice. So if they're living, if they're doing and working on the stock market, well, this is not conducive to meditative practice. And ultimately,
if
practice is more important than your job, then you'll probably find a different job.
Okay. Okay, very interesting. But the masters that are here right now, they know who the other masters are. You said they know when a child's born, so...
Yes, there are, there are a specific group of masters, I believe, who specialize in that particular, almost, let's call it clairvoyant, for want of a better word, but it's almost a clairvoyant vision of where masters are being reborn into this world. And those masters, pretty much that is their dedicated practice, that they will actually be piecing together the evidence to find the new reincarnated masters and will travel the world to find them. And then, as C said, to sort of test the child. I mean, it's a test of sort, but, you know, just confirm, make sure that the child is actually a confirmed reincarnate.
Yes, very interesting. Okay, so just a specific question to both of you. When did you first know that you wanted to do this, go down this path, learn this practice?
Well, when it presented itself to me, it was, again, the only practice that ultimately made sense where, again, there was no red flags and there was no aspect of, you know, because there's a lot of, especially now, there's a lot of good books, you know, written by many great masters that speak to Dzogchen as a practice that you can actually get into. And you can just read text after text after text after text, and there's nothing in them that causes you to back up and say, oh, that doesn't make sense. That seems like a funny story, or that seems doesn't, you know, you know, so when I stumbled on Dzogchen, I was already well advanced in my pursuit of spiritual practices and trying to understand who I was. And almost all of them had limitations for me. And Dzogchen was the one that just was like, okay, I get it. I'm going to just pursue this one. So that was in the kind of early to mid-90s for me, when Dzogchen was kind of beginning to emerge here, maybe in the United States. It might have been a little earlier in Europe, but I stumbled on it in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
And for me, it was more recent. I began with other meditation practices. I began with transcendental meditation, and I found that to be extremely rewarding in the sense that it offered me a technique, like a very precise technique to calm my mind and focus on the mantra. So I'm not sure if you know much about that, but you repeat a mantra. And so that's a very strictly guided meditation in that sense, because you repeat a mantra. But what this does, it really helps you to calm the mind. And, you know, and I come from I was experiencing a very hectic, stressful career. And so transcendental meditation was a really good tool. And it was like giving me a tool that could teach me to calm that thinking mind down. And so I did this for quite a while, and but I felt that and that was great, and I'm really grateful for that teaching. But then I felt there was something more. I wanted to go deeper, and I wanted to spend more time there. And I recognized that there was a state of consciousness, as it were, but I didn't really know what it was, and I wanted to know what that was. And when Chris introduced me to Dzogchen, he said, well, look, try this, you know, now that if you're enjoying your meditation, so try this, here's a book. And he handed me book after book after book, and I was like, give me another one. and so I just spent a couple of years of just reading these great masters, and I was just devouring these books, because intellectually it stimulated me and it allowed my imagination to take me there. And so when I was practicing, I realized that I no longer needed the mantra, I began practicing without the mantra. And then I began to really practice Dzogchen, and the space opened up for me, and I was able to train myself to spend longer periods in this state, and that just got me hooked. And so I'm like, right, this is it. I'm your partner for life in this.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you do when you find there's major distractions in your life with, you know, outside that your family or things like that, the other distractions? What do you do to get back on track?
Well, you use them. They, you know, they're like fuel for the fire. It's like throwing another log on the fire. And in the book I speak to, you know, there was one night I was meditating while writing the book, and we were out in the desert. We have this amazing desert space. And the winds really get fierce out there. They're, you know, 100-mile-an-hour winds. And, you know, so sitting practicing in a really, really good place in my meditation, and the winds start kicking up and just blowing the trees around and all kinds of activity happening outside, you know, enough to raise the alarm, you know, like concern. You can use the practice with all of these distractions, all of these events, you know, like growing up in Los Angeles, and practicing in Los Angeles, there's helicopters above you all the time. And you kind of like use the helicopter as, you know, as a radar of sorts. It becomes like a radar blip in your awareness, and you begin to observe your awareness in relationship to the sound of the helicopter and the thundering of it. And, you know, so the activity and the distractions in your life become helpful and a part of the practice, and you want to use it that way. And it becomes quite fun to begin to look at the awareness as it's observing these sounds or chaotic events around you. And
may I say it also, because you mentioned when you're around family and relationships, and it's really with practice, you become aware that let's say that you engage in a scuffle of sorts with a family member, you know, or they say something hurtful, or there's potential for an argument to outbreak. And you know what can happen is that you, with the practice, is you recognize in this moment that the energies are shifting, and somebody's maybe becoming a little bit wild with their tongue, and they might be saying things, maybe they've had a few too many glasses of wine, and they're saying something that isn't so comfortable. You recognize in that moment that you and that person are two beings that are in this space, and your awareness is actually observing this play out in front of you. And so what that can do is it won't stop their behavior. They are going to behave as they are going to behave. But what it will do is it will bring awareness to your reaction to this behavior. And when you start to watch yourself behave in a way that it doesn't, you don't act in reaction to their anger or their offensive remark that they just made. You actually watch these feelings and emotions of perhaps hurt or shame or humiliation that rise up in you, but you let them rise, and they rise and they fall away. And then with a certain sense of peaceful action, you actually find that skills are given to you in that moment to actually calm the situation down and respond with kindness, and perhaps, you know, suggest to them that perhaps that wasn't so nice of them or kind with them, you know. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously I'm just using a very sort of hypothetical situation here. I'm probably not explaining it very well, but you notice quite quickly in your practice that throughout the day, something comes out of left field and knocks you off guard, but you recognize it as it's happening. And so you're able to let that pass you by. And so what you don't do anymore is jump in and react and add fuel to that aggressive fire.
Wow, that could be a very, very good practice, a very good way of living. Not get so hyper with all the stupid things your, you know, family and neighbors do.
That's right. That's so true. And if we think about that aspect, which of course involves others, also the silly, stupid things that we do with ourselves. You know, those thoughts that pop up in your brain and say, why did you do that, you silly thing? And how could you say that? Or you're just not good enough. And, you know, all those little voices in your head. And with more and more practice, you let those voices, the voices are going to happen and the voices are going to say things, but they come and they go. And you actually just watch them come and go. And you say hello to the ego and you say goodbye to the ego. And you just watch it float in and float out. And so you become much less judgmental about yourself, first and foremost. And then you become much more less judgmental about others around you.
Uh-huh. And then you can be more at peace with yourself and,
Yeah, that's right. And you start to begin to perceive your world from a place of loving kindness. And I know that might sound like a little bit of a cliche, but it's not something that you're trying to do. You're not trying to be kind. You're not trying to be loving. You just, a little bit every day, you just become a little bit more kind and a little bit more loving and a little bit less angry and a little bit less judgmental. And this will happen just gradually. It will be a progressive arc towards this if you just dedicate a few minutes a day, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, maybe 20, and build yourself up and just do a little bit of practice every day. And then this starts to become a part of your way of interacting with your world and with your people and with your loved ones around you. And this is how you begin to interact with your world on the outside as well.
Very interesting. This all comes from just sitting quietly with your thoughts and becoming aware of your inner thoughts.
Yeah,
because what you're doing when you sit down to practice is you're not trying to focus on nothingness. You're not trying to just relax or relieve stress. You're going there to be clear, on point, aware of your awareness, aware of what's allowing this ego to kind of run wild and create these kind of problematic situations. So the training takes place while you're sitting. And the skill is developing while you're sitting. And then when you get up and get out and start moving through the world, you bring that with you. And, you know, so while you're watching yourself and your thoughts in meditation, you begin to observe yourself as you're interacting with the person in the grocery store, you know, the checker who's going way too slow and making too many mistakes. And you're watching, instead of them making mistakes, you're watching your mind speak to this. And this becomes a very fascinating exchange. And now you're less railing against the people who you perceive are slowing you down and not doing their job properly. And now you're looking at yourself and saying, oh, wow, that's interesting. Look at all that language you're putting to this moment. So from people are observing you from a different perspective. They're no longer seeing an angry, you know, like hurry up kind of guy. They're seeing this person who's calm and just patient and observing a scene as it's unfolding, and you become much more of a pleasant presence in their lives as well. So suddenly the response to you becomes much more favorable, and you really start to feel good about things because people are starting to be kinder to you because you're kinder to them. It just happens. It's not like, you know, you're trying to, I'm going to be a kind person today, because that there again is another thought, and there's another idea that, but our subconscious takes over very quickly, and all of our old behaviors kick in very quickly. But
yeah.
It can't do that when the awareness is up front and present.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Very interesting. Just thinking about that, I'm thinking, yeah, I did kind of blow up as somebody yesterday, and I probably shouldn't have. And now you're making me feel really guilty about that.
Good. Good. You should feel terrible.
Oh, well.
No, it's wonderful. Well, it's wonderful because you recognize moments where, I mean, it's not about patting yourself on the back, you know, but you recognize, oh, wow, you know, I handled that really well. You know, I didn't respond to my mother in that terrible tone that I usually use, you know, or you know, I didn't insult my sibling like I used to do, you know, and you know, and that's okay, and it's good. And when you recognize that you're being just a little bit more thoughtful, well, mindful is the word, you know, when you're being mindful of those around you, and, you know, that's okay. You can give yourself a pat on the back and just say, well done, let's bring more of that behavior into the world. And as C says, when you behave like that, they start to behave like that towards you, and you can really experience a beautiful, loving, kind world around you. And I think that leads us back to that concept of the collective consciousness grows together because we inspire each other to be loving, kind individuals. And, you know, but this comes from practice of with yourself. Like learning how to enter into that deep space within yourself, which is the essence of loving kindness. Because when you enter into this beautiful spaciousness, this spaciousness is literally filled with love, loving kindness and compassion and a love for all beings. And this is really where the teachings are pointing us.
Hmm. So you're saying that the state of loving kindness is much more natural than the angry, anxious states we get into.
Well, yeah, anger is born of we want to change something. We're frustrated. So
yes.
We're not accepting things for how they are. We want it different. So anger arises, frustration arises. Love comes from a place of simply loving what's happening around you. You're in acceptance, you're in allowance. And so part of the Dzogchen practice is recognizing that space itself allows for everything. Our awareness by nature allows for everything. Awareness doesn't get in the way of anything. Awareness sees everything. Awareness is aware of everything. It's the ego and it's our attempt to change things to how we want it to be, or if we're not getting what we want to try to, you know, push our way into getting what we want. This is what, so the anger and all of this stuff is what is very much aligned with the ego. And once the ego and begins to fall away and awareness begins to rise, what's natural to awareness is love. What's natural to awareness is joy. What's natural to awareness is kindness and patience. So this comes with it. Again, you're not trying to rope it in and make it your own. It comes with it.
Okay. So then you'd recommend this practice to everybody.
Oh, God, yes.
Yes.
God, you know, we can really start healing the planet if all of us begin to practice Dzogchen, because, you know, we wouldn't be trying to stake our claims and take things, and you know, like, you know, we would just be in allowance and we'd be wanting to work together and share. And you know, part of the nature of these teachings is to share it out, not in a way where you're missionizing, But you wait for the person who's like seeking like guidance, and they ask for the guidance, and you go, look, there's a practice here. Let's we could do this. This is the way forward for all of us to grow and enlighten and to open our hearts.
Mm-hmm. So it's recommended for everybody all the time then.
yes.
And people are just starting to realize it.
Yes. You know, and again, it's like everything. Even if we just all did a little bit every day, that would begin to make such a difference. Mm. And so, you know, it's like everything. It takes time. It's a progressive growth. And so, if everybody could find just a few minutes a day to start and just to do this, and then they themselves will experience all this beauty and benefits that they receive in their life, and they themselves will then be encouraged and inspired to do a little bit longer and a little bit longer and a little bit more and each day, and so, you know, it will just be a beautiful progression throughout our whole communities.
Okay, well, it's interesting. You're talking about progression here. Is there something that this enlightenment is progressing towards? I mean, what is the ultimate goal?
Well, the ultimate goal, obviously, without really being a targeted goal, but the ultimate goal is enlightenment. And that enlightenment is the absolute release of all attachment, including your ego. And actually, it's quite beautiful. I believe it was Sonia Rinpoche, the master that C mentioned earlier, in one of his books, the Tibetan word for ego is actually ownership. And so when I read this, a light bulb went off in my mind, because if we actually see that our ego, our own ego, is that which owns, so that which we perceive is ours, that which owns ourselves, that which owns our land, owns our houses, owns our children, owns our community, owns our government, this idea of ownership is that which leads us away from the spiritual path. And so if we're able to release ownership and see that we are here as a shared consciousness, and we share everything, we share our lives together, we share our love together, we share the land together, this beautiful planet that we are born into, this beautiful human species that we are born to, if we are to share this and not see it as a selfish ownership of our own lives, then this will give birth to a spiritual path.
That sounds very Native American.
Well, yes, it does. It really does, in the sense that these older, more ancient traditions, they really spoke to living at ease with everything, and that means absolute acceptance of everything that occurs and everything that happens, but also living at one and at peace with everything. And, you know, we can all remember this. We can all be this. We can all return to this way of being. It's something that is innately within each and every one of us. You know, the Buddha says that we all have Buddha within us. We all have the capacity to be Buddha, to enter into Buddhahood. And all this means is that this beautiful essence of who we are is within each and every one of us, and that essence is pure consciousness, and we can all access this. But we've forgotten who we are and how we get there, but these teachings can point us there and can actually retrain us to recognize this inner state and recognize the essence of who we are. And that essence of who we all are is love and peace.
Sounds easy.
Yeah. I like it. We keep flipping back and forth. Sounds hard. Sounds easy. Sounds like, because it really is like that. when you read it and you start thinking about it, you go, oh, that sounds easy. And then you start talking about the difficulties. Yes, that sounds hard. And it's true. It's all of it. And that's, you know, but this is what makes it compelling as well. It's not a static process. It's a process that completely aligns with our everyday selves, where things are easy at times and things are hard at times. And it's Dzogchen is this way. At times it is very difficult because we're thinking way too much about it and we're trying to really get our heads around it and we make it difficult. But then when we release and we settle into this kind of like our own state where we're not really bound by thought, not bound by our needs to do things, we recognize how easy it is. And so it's this back and forth continually, which keeps it interesting.
Yes. Okay. Well, since we're almost done with this show now, why don't we break off here a little bit and tell people how to get in touch with you for more information or more conversation or whatever.
Wonderful, thank you. Yes, well, your audience can go to enteringthemind.com, and this will take you to a page in a magazine, which is called Riot Material. But this page will give you access to the book, so you can click on book, and you will have access to the book. You'll read about the book, and you can also purchase the book there. There's a link. We also have a three-part podcast that C and I prepared, so your audience can click on the three-part podcast, and that is C and I speaking to the key concepts in the book, so they can actually hear more about the book. And then also we have you can click on the tour, and that will take you to some of our radio and podcast tours, interviews, that we've been invited on. So this recording will be put there as a replay, and we're excited to share that with our readers of our magazine. And so your audience can access that too if they're interested. So enteringthemind.com, that is how you can get in touch with us.
Okay. Well, that's good that information's out there. And I'll send you a copy of this podcast, you know, tomorrow. And
thank you.
Anything you guys would like to say in conclusion, since we've been chatting the whole time with my questions about Dzogchen and the ego and things?
Well, thank you so much for your amazing questions. We've both thoroughly enjoyed them, and it's just been such a great conversation. I think I would just like to say that to your audience, if you are considering entering into a meditation practice, or you're just curious about beginning a spiritual path, I just want to say there's no right or wrong way. Every way is unique to each individual. And if something is pulling you and drawing you in, something that you think might help you broaden your perspective along your own spiritual path, then follow that with curiosity and with your, childlike curiosity, and just enjoy the journey, enjoy the path, and open up your heart and enjoy everything that experience brings to you. I really think there's no right or wrong way. If you even just begin by drinking your tea in the morning in silence, just for a few minutes, and just sit with yourself, that could unfold into all sorts of beautiful insights that can come to you, that where you might decide, okay, I'm starting to feel comfortable with myself, and this is feeling good. So anyway, you know, taking a walk in nature and just looking at the birds and the plants that are just there for our enjoyment, and they're gifted to us, and just experiencing the beautiful nature of the planet, you know, anything that can just bring your heart into a state of love and openness, I say that's what can inspire you to follow your own path and find your own way in all of this.
Okay. Sounds simple and enough.
You...
Well, saying?
Of course. Well, of course, you can go and buy the book also.
Yeah.
I think you'll enjoy the book from a literary perspective. If you like to read, I mean, the book has a lovely flow to it, and it really goes into concepts that are quite, you know, I try to make it as interesting as possible, and I think it's, you know, like this discussion here, there's a lot to get to on it and to really ponder, and that alone is quite exciting. So, you know, from a literary readership perspective, it's an enjoyable book as well. It's not heavy at all.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I thank you both for this lovely conversation tonight.
Beautiful conversation.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you, Dorian.
Yes. Thank you for everything that you're doing and sharing
you're
with
amazing.
The world. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All right. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.